Hello, everybody, and welcome to Beyond Awakening, the Future of Spiritual Practice. I'm Terry Patton, the creator and host of this series. I'm also the founder and teacher of Integral Spiritual Practice and the author of Integral Life Practice with Ken Wilber. So this morning we're going to be continuing our exploration of how our spirituality can, in our extreme 21st century world, make good on its promise to uplift and change all of human life with Buddhist teacher Sharon Salzberg. As you may know, I convened this series to serve the evolution of consciousness and culture by creating a deep public dialogue about how spirituality can play a key role in helping us find the inner resources that can enable human beings to rise to the challenges of a world in crisis, and to make this critical transition, this critical evolutionary transition, to a sustainable human presence on our beloved planet. We've had a series of profound and enlivening and diverse and intense conversations in which we've focused on many different specific aspects of this huge question. So the way this will work is that I'll introduce Sharon and then we'll dialogue for about an hour, and then I'll make some announcements and we'll spend about a half an hour taking your questions, and then we'll finish up in about 90 minutes. Sharon Salzberg has been one of the key Western teachers who's helped bring Buddhist meditation practice into the mainstream over the past four decades. Originally intrigued by the message of Buddhism that she encountered by reading Chogyam Trungpa's Meditation in Action in a college Asian philosophy course, Sharon traveled to India and spent several years engaged in intensive study with highly respected Buddhist teachers. And then she returned to America in 1974 and began teaching Vipassana. 2 years later, together with Joseph Goldstein and Jack Kornfield, she established the Insight Meditation Society in Barre, Massachusetts, which is now really one of the most prominent active meditation centers in the Western world. Sharon and Joseph also co-founded the Barre Center for Buddhist Studies and the Forest Refuge. And she is one of the founding and most influential Western teachers of Buddhism in America and really in the West. She's traveled all over the world speaking and teaching Buddhist meditation and has served on many panels, including several with His Holiness the Dalai Lama. He's really one of her most important teachers, but there are many other great Buddhist teachers who have been key to her development, including S.N. Goenka, Munindra, Deepa Ma, Kalu Rinpoche, Tulku Urgyen, and many others. She's also taught with many of the most influential Western teachers, including Ram Dass, Pema Chodron, Daniel Goleman, Surya Das, Joan Halifax, John Kabat-Zinn, and probably others I'm not thinking to name. She's the author of the Buddhist classic, Loving Kindness, as well as Insight Meditation, a step-by-step course on how to meditate, and Faith, Trusting Your Own Deepest Experience. Her newest book is titled Real Happiness, and it's a month-long guide to really getting your meditation practice going, and it's beautifully, beautifully written, wonderful book. She's a consistent voice of wholesome sanity, and one who has carefully and compassionately taught thousands and thousands of people how to meditate and really guided them through that process. So it's with deep respect and delight that I welcome you, Sharon. I'm so happy that you're my guest this morning.
Thank you so much.
Well, you know, you've played a role for almost as many years now as the guy that I sometimes regard as our kind of Western progenitor grandfather, Ram Dass, even though you're much younger. To use the phrase Rick Fields used in his book, in helping the swans not only come to the lake but reproduce, you're part of that second generation of swans.
That's funny.
and so bringing about this first generation of Western teachers of Eastern spirituality has been a cultural change. You've participated in a process through which there has been the intrusion of the science of esoteric development into the lives of many, many people, such that meditation has become more and more of a mainstream influence through lots of people. Daniel Goleman's particularly noteworthy in that way. You've seen a cultural change take place. And here we are at a time in which the world seems to be experiencing a tremendous crescendo of chaotic disturbances, whether we think of that in terms of climate or the financial system or culture wars. It seems like things are shaking harder and harder, and a lot of people are feeling like something really new needs to arise, that this fever pitch is requiring a qualitative shift, some sort of a momentous leap. Do you agree? And if so, how might spiritual practice contribute to something like that?
I do agree. I mean, I went to India in 1970, so it's been some time, and I began my meditation practice in 1971 in January, and that's where I actually met Ram Dass. At the time, he was considered sort of the elder, almost the patriarch. He'd been to India before. He was experienced. He was older. And looking back, I was really shocked to realize that at the time, he was about 37, you know. But, of course, I was 18, so that was very different, too.
He was the grand old man at 37.
He was. He was really like, wow, the elder. You know, what I've seen through the years has certainly been a gradual acceptance of things like meditation practice into the culture in general. When I first came back from India in 1974, I'd be at a party or some social situation, and people would say to me, what do you do? And I'd say, I teach meditation. And they would kind of go, ooh, that's weird. And sort of sidle away. But now, of course, the single most common response I get, even somewhere strange, like coming back into the country through customs or something, people will say, what do you do? And I say, I teach meditation. And they'll mostly say, I'm so stressed out, I could really use some of that, which is very different. But meditation doesn't just imply getting less stressed. It also means having very personal, direct sense of what's true, not believing everything you're told, learning how to listen deeply, how to look clearly at life's experience. It means maybe redefining happiness and strength and concepts we have about aloneness and competition compared to how connected we might feel to one another and responsive we might feel to one another's needs. And so meditation can and should be actually something very, very radical. And I think that it can provide some of that impetus for a next step for this society and this world.
Well, I'm in total agreement with that. A certain basic sanity and happiness and wholesome clarity seems like it is the foundation. And yet, evolution seems to proceed sometimes by intensifying the stresses in order to evoke new emergent qualities. And life has been difficult forever, and meditation has been part of, mm-hmm. you know, at least the cultures of the East for thousands of years. And it's certainly had a positive effect in various ways. It's not to say that the spirituality of the past has not affected human consciousness and culture. It certainly mm-hmm. has. But it's almost like it's kind of informed and marbled and softened certain aspects of those cultures, but we see tremendous mm-hmm. craziness and brutality in Eastern cultures. And in some ways, Western cultures have coped, you know, it's a mixed mm-hmm. record. We can't really say one is better and one is worse, but there have been mm-hmm. you know, strengths to the West. Is, you know, in some ways the West has been much stronger than the East, certainly in terms of building prosperity and addressing public health issues and a variety of other things.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So, you know, meditation isn't the answer to everything, and yet we're in a worldwide crisis, and somehow we, as conscious people with a global a level of awareness, a kind of world-centric perspective on who we are, want to be part of a healthy human adaptive response
to this
squeeze point. It's like that being in a world out of balance, to me, it feels like, you know, it's the grain of sand in the oyster, you know, it's trying to require some pearl to come forth.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And so it does seem like there's something about the acceleration of things in our time that isn't, you know, some would say it's unique, some would say no, it's a new version of something that's, you know, age old. But maybe it leads to something new. How new is it? How do you feel that?
Mm-hmm.
How does it goad you in your practice to deepen in the tradition, but maybe find something, some expression of it that is original and fresh and unique in this time?
Well, I mean, I would certainly never want to imply that meditation is the answer to everything by any means, but maybe another way of casting that is that wisdom needs to be an ingredient in responsiveness and the ways we view the world, because if we're acting out of ignorance or partisanship or even just kind of immediate emotional reaction without a basis of a lot of insight or wisdom, it's not going to go far enough, it's not going to be sustained enough, and it's not going to be comprehensive enough. And so for me, of course, given my life and the way my life has evolved, meditation has been an enormous factor in my efforts to move toward greater wisdom or insight. But that's not to say it's the only way by any means to achieve that. I think one thing that's different is it's not even perhaps so much a new expression of these truths or of these methods of meditation to come to a deeper, more personal sense of the truth, but it's more a sense of accessibility and openness and taking the democratic values of the West and really using them to help make this methodology much more available if people want to pursue it. And so, you know, if you look at Asian society and you look at the roles of the monasteries, very often they were the only bastions of literacy in a culture, for example. A lot of the techniques of meditation, although meant to be available to everybody, would more or less be held within those monastic enclaves in Asia. And now, both in Asia and in the West, you know, we live in a time where people aren't so happy kind of deferring to the potential liberation of someone else and saying, well, yeah, you know, I'll support you and I'll help feed you and make sure your needs are met so you can really have some profound spiritual understanding and be transformed in the best possible way, not in a narcissistic way or a greedy way, but in the most authentic kind of integrated way. People are saying, what about me? You know, I need to be free too. I'm not just an outsider or a bystander looking in at your transformation. You know, I need to transform as well. And that, I think, has revitalized these ancient teachings and really brought them to life in a very different way, and it's quite essential. So my work in some ways is not, I don't think, to change the methodology so much, but to language it in such a way and to offer it in such a way so that my communication is really as personal and direct as possible for our time and for our culture. Like in my last book, Real Happiness, I showed it to a friend in California when I was on the book tour, and they kind of flipped through it, and he said, oh, you wrote this one in American. And I thought, that's a great compliment. That's exactly what I wanted to do.
Right, right. You know, that it's an interesting thing. As I hear you say that, I realize, gosh, there are so many different places that we can hang as we confront these profound questions. I really appreciate the kind of restedness and you know, that word wholesomeness and and sanity too. You know, are words that come to mind right away when I think of what I appreciate most about your work. In my last interview, I spoke with Andrew Harvey, who's a brilliant and incredibly eloquent and very, very passionate and very deep, you know, spiritual practitioner. And his mood, you know, is, I wouldn't say that it's unwholesome or insane, you know, but it's very intense. He's like, you know, this world is heading for a kind of collapse, and the mother is grieving, and we need to let our hearts break and go through a dark night of the soul and do a kind of shadow work that we don't realize. We're all in denial. You and I are in denial. We need to let our heart break. You know, he's really trying to help wake us up with a very, you know, intense kind of clarion call, and a sense that he was even saying to me in a, I think it was in a private conversation rather than the broadcast, you know, what's so great about happiness? I don't want people to be so, I want them to be more afraid. I want them to wake up out of their denial, you know. And there's some truth in those kinds of points of view. And as you sound this other tone, it might be fruitful to ask you to, well, you know, in every, there's a saying in integral theory that Ken Wilber, who has been an important mentor and friend and collaborator for me, every perspective is both true and partial. And so I'm sure you see the partial truth, at least, in what Andrew was saying, you know, and have a place in yourself for that. How do you include that and still rest in the place where you stand?
Well, I actually just saw Andrew the other night for the first time in 20 years. And it was delightful to see him, and he chastised me for Buddhist seeming passivity in the face of the tremendous crisis this earth is undergoing, and it was the nicest possible kind of way to be chastised. But we agreed that, you know, we couldn't have the conversation right then, which was the end of a presentation of his, and in a crowd of people, but we'd have to have the conversation. Well, I would certainly come down on the side of happiness, because I don't think of happiness as just the experience of pleasure. I don't think it has to make us lazy and self-satisfied by any means. I think in contrast to that, you know, there's the bumper sticker which says something like, if you're not depressed, you're not paying attention. But I know plenty of people who are depressed, and they're overwhelmed, and they're frustrated, and they feel broken, and they feel shattered in the face of suffering. They feel helpless. They feel that what they can contribute toward the good could never be enough because the crisis is so bad, and so they've given up. They feel defeated, and I don't see that that does any good at all. You know, it's self-destructive. It just, we get so demoralized and just overcome by that kind of pain that is actually what takes center stage rather than a vision of possibility. And but it's not, I mean, it's certainly understandable. It's not incomprehensible at all how one can feel just crushed in the face of suffering. And but there's something else that needs to happen for us to be mobilized, to feel an effort can be sustained, to actually join together with other people, to do the good that's in front of us, even if we don't know where it's going to go, and we don't know that we're going to get immediate satisfaction or gratification for what we want to see happen, and we just have to. I think of, I taught at Walter Reed Army Hospital once for a group of nurses there. It was National or International Nurses Week, and someone had set it up for me because they had all these programs of people coming in and offering these different things for the nurses, and I have a friend who's a nurse there, and she also arranged for me to have a short tour of one of the wards, and of course it was extremely painful and very, very, very intense to be there, and even so briefly. And at the end of the tour, my friend turned to me and said, you know, the nurses who can stay here, and of course that means the ones who can keep giving and sharing and seeking to help. She said, the nurses who can stay here are not the ones who get lost in sorrow. The nurses who can stay here are the ones who can connect to the resiliency of the human spirit. And I thought, okay, you know, that is a way of defining compassion. It's not just to be overwhelmed and even, you know, moved and troubled and distressed, but to be able to connect to something of resiliency that's onward leading, some kind of vision, because that's how we can actually stay there.
Yeah. Beautiful. I deeply resonate. And in that connecting with what is resilient in the human spirit, which is in a sense the same as what's resilient in life itself,
mm-hmm,
or in being,
mm-hmm,
I guess. There's a, I feel at least, and I think many do, a desire to somehow enact in our own lives a, you know, sometimes what we're feeling is a battle with our own demons and our own,
mm-hmm,
tendency toward despondency or despair or depression. Sometimes it's more a struggle for relevancy, for creative contribution. You know, we,
mm-hmm,
want to be a part of a healthy human adaptive response in a crazy time. We want to be the healthy thing instead of just being swept in this tide of imbalance and exaggeration.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we want a vision for how we could come together, somehow how our own private acts of sanity or wholesomeness could be part of some kind of cultural renewal or transformation.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I'm sure you sit with these questions deeply, not just in your role as a teacher, but as a,
mm-hmm,
as a human being. And I'm curious, because it seems to me that there are things that are emergent and that we're kind of holding deep koans together and letting them work us, that we're not only working with the Dharma that's already been spoken, but holding the possibility of emergence of new clarities.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I just want to invite you to expand on that, because I feel, you know, that that's so vital for so many of us now.
Well, I think as human beings, one of the things I've really also learned to do more of through my own practice, my own meditation practices, has been to look at the small things, to look at the moment, to look at and honor, not just look at, but really feel immersed in and touched by the seemingly small gesture or the act that doesn't seem like it's going to eradicate the world's suffering today or even tomorrow, but that is an affirmation of some kind of connection that's based on a vision of our lives mattering to one another. So even if it seems very small, I've really felt, I've discovered and have remained in the confidence of how imperative it is to do that act, whatever it might be, you know, just giving someone your attention or some money or listening or, you know, doing one small thing. I really feel those things are quite powerful. And then in terms of a community, I absolutely agree. I think what we need is a kind of inspiration, because together people can do extraordinary things that are courageous and audacious and are at the same time not like a kind of violent retaliation against being harmed or being oppressed, but are reaching a whole other level. And I think, you know, it's interesting that this is the 50th anniversary of the Freedom Riders in the South, and just watching those depictions, it's like I was young then, and I'd forgotten how incredibly violent it was. You know, people on buses that are set on fire by people, you know, hoping to see them burnt to death. And these people are, you know, they're scared and they're injured and they get on another bus. And there was one, there was a TV show about it the other night that I was watching, and there was one scene where this federal official, who's now, of course, you know, 50 years older, was talking about being a federal official then in the South. And this woman was was being beaten, and she was he was trying to pull her to safety, and she said to him, you know, I've been trained in nonviolence. I'm okay. I'm afraid you're going to get hurt. And in fact, someone did hit him with a shovel, and he ends up in the hospital. But, you know, where do we find that now, that way of having such a strong adherence to a principle of both strength and nonviolence, and that we can come together and really keep going, you know, get back on the next bus the next day. We need a kind of inspiration that we, you know, perhaps are not going to have one leader that's going to lead us there. Perhaps we're going to have to find that inspiration in a very different way.
Yeah. You know, I'm reminded of Thich Nhat Hanh's wonderful and often quoted comment that the next Buddha may be a Sangha.
Mm-hmm.
We've even talked in some of the previous dialogues in this series about is it possible perhaps for what I've sometimes called a meta-sangha to arise in which the clarities or agreements that a broad number of practitioners in different schools might have might help us feel a different kind of fellowship and intimacy and access to each other and ability to stand together as a force of sanity and love.
You mean metta with one T or two T's?
I met with one T,
okay.
Yes. Metta, that is one that kind of transcends and includes the sanghas, yeah.
Because, you know, of course, metta with two T's is the word in Pali for loving kindness. So.
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, it would be both, wouldn't it?
It could be both. A metta sangha.
You know, one line of thought about that is that maybe this just naturally has to evolve spontaneously out of the deep practice of individuals. And yet there's another line of consideration that we've heard from some of the guests in this series, that this is a time for evolutionary spirituality, that evolution is, you know, that even the greatest of the ancient dharmas arose in a world in which time was imagined to be cyclical and that things didn't essentially change.
Uh-huh.
And that this new picture of the world that we've gotten through the Hubble telescope and everything else, in which we have this 13.7 billion year trajectory and that things have gotten more complex and interconnected and conscious, you know, we're heading somewhere. And and therefore, the ancient and eternal truths are absolutely foundational and need to be, you know, never honored or treated as if they're just another point of view. But but that still there's something in this time that is singular where, you know, there's a lot at stake. We don't want cultural regression. We don't want evolutionary regression. We don't want to go back to Mad Max or human extinction or any of those crazinesses.
Mm-hmm.
And so what do we, how does evolution elicit something new from us even as we rest in the changeless?
Well, maybe that's out of our hands. You know, I mean, I think the manifestation of one's deepest insight and deepest wisdom is, I think, necessarily going to be expressed through the idiom of one's time, and that's going to include both the deepest, most evident sources of suffering. Not deepest may not be right, but most evident in terms of what we see before us, and the willingness to engage rather than disengage. And so, you know, we can know deeply, deeply from within ourselves and our clearest experience and kind of almost as a sort of irrefutable truth that all of life is connected and that we are not, however alone we might feel or cut off or separate, that the truth is all of life is interconnected, and that when we, you know, eat a string bean or something like that, that's not just happenstance. It didn't just poof arise in our hand or fork. That we have come to that moment in time through a confluence of all these conditions. You know, somebody planted a seed in the ground, and there are creatures who live in that soil, and somebody harvested that crop and transported it and sold it or prepared it for us and sold it to us, and we could buy the string bean because we have a job or we have a source of income, we have a source of money. And, you know, that didn't just happen. That happened because of a confluence of causes and conditions and relationships. And, you know, it's the way Thich Nhat Hanh will hold something like a string bean in his hand in front of a group of people and say, now see the world.
Mm-hmm.
Because we can. And that's just the truth of things. And the more we know that, not just intellectually or theoretically, but very deeply, then, you know, we have a situation right in front of us where either people are being motivated by a vision of life that's very different, that's excluding rather than including, that's based on separation rather than on the truth of connection, and we need to respond to it right now because it's right in front of us. And the way that insight will be contoured and expressed will be based on that situation that's right in front of us. It'll be very contextualized, and that's what keeps the insight kind of alive and vital and vibrant, is that it's continually being expressed in a very real and immediate way.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you don't just sit back in the monastery happily contemplating the truth of interconnection. You know, you're relating to people all the time.
And reemerging from whatever subtle qualities of withdrawal or separation are tending to accrete.
Mm-hmm.
Is that what you mean? Yeah. You know, it might be really richest for many of the folks who are tuning in to, if I invite you to help lead us through a process of maybe pointing out instructions or guidance that might evoke or invoke that sense of real happiness, and for us to drop to that ground and conduct the next phase of this conversation out of that disposition.
Oh, you mean like a meditation practice?
If that's what comes to you, or just a consideration, sure.
Yeah, I mean, even just the you know, I like the reflection in a way. Another variation on what I was just talking about, which is just to think quietly for a few moments of all the many people who are somehow involved in your listening to the show right now. Like who told you about it or influenced you to think more deeply about life, and who helped you learn how to take some risks so you were willing to look at things in a different way. You know, because these things also happen because of a confluence of conditions and connections and relationships and conversations and encounters. This moment in time, too, is really a sense of, it's like a river, all these different things coming together to make it happen, that we're here together, in effect, right now. Sometimes when I do this reflection, I go back to, I went to India in 1970 as a college student through the State University of New York at Buffalo, which had an independent study program. And so sometimes I do this reflection and I think, well, you know, my life evolved this way, part because of the Board of Regents of the State of New York, which gave me a scholarship so I could go to college, so I could go to India. And they're a part of why I'm here right now in this moment. You know, so this very moment in time, I think sometimes when I do this reflection, I think of the people whose actions have really, really hurt me. Not just the ones I find kind of annoying or irritating, but the ones where I really feel I've been brought to an edge, so that I thought, okay, I have got to see things differently. I have got to become free of this, or I'll never be happy. And, you know, because they're, in fact, a part of my being here right now in this moment, too. And just this big, big world, this big sense of connection that is the truth of this moment, not just to pleasant people, but to so many, many beings. And so this kind of reflection has me, it does give me a quality of some rest within and a very different kind of happiness because, you know, again, not the happiness of just pleasant experience or being giddy or something like that, but feeling so profoundly connected through time and through space to really all of life.
Yeah, absolutely. Feeling, you know, I feel myself as a, it's almost like I'm a conscious cell in the larger body of something vast, and inherently I have a particular and limited point of view in the midst of it, but at the root of my being, I'm a part of something that isn't limited to the to what I can see from here. And I can feel that connectedness and feel a kind of gratitude insofar as I can relax any, you know, if it's a difficult moment in which I'm agitated and in tension with existence, it can be harder. But if I can relax below that, if I'm fundamentally connected to a sense of well-being, gratitude is really what arises. Yeah. I know a lot of us are on a funny edge in which we're in one moment very disturbed. You know, reading the news can be an ordeal, or watching the news. And then in other moments, you know, or just our own lives are difficult. The financial crisis has hurt so many people. The sense of insecurity, this fear in the space, more than there was 10 years ago. And so sometimes it's about finding our own happiness, and then sometimes it's about finding a way to be rightly related to a crazy, crazy world. And somehow I don't think those are entirely separate, but they certainly are different aspects of something fundamental.
Yeah. Well, I think, you know, it's hard to contemplate a quality like balance and not to feel that it's vapid or, you know, unimportant. It's very important. It's like that sense of resiliency. You know, we need some kind of balance. And that's why I always come back to almost like shifting perspective, like get smaller, you know, in terms of one's source of joy. You know, it's, I think especially people who are very aware and caught up in the ills and the tribulations of the world can feel almost guilty about enjoying a sunset or a child's smile or something like that, and it just depletes us in the end. And also get bigger, you know, realize that, I mean, I'm awed by the goodness that is displayed and just the good-heartedness as people are not thinking about national identity or tribalism and working all around the world for a better world that is so inclusive of so many other kinds of people. And, you know, it's very hard for us, I think, because we're also we're so bound up in time, and especially if you're very aware of the news, it's maddening because it feels like you know, it's just this barrage of negativity sometimes, and it all seems to be falling apart. But things take time; they really do take time, and that we can't lose heart, and we have to keep going.
Yeah, you know, it's often said that optimism in the face of all this is a moral imperative.
It's good.
Yeah. I don't know if it's optimism like a positive opinion about the chances so much.
Yeah.
It's just a kind of, I'm looking at what can be healthy. I'm finding my way toward what I can give, where I can, you know, what I can love, what I can be grateful for, what I can contribute, where I can love, where I can relax and know the inherent goodness of it all.
Yeah.
No matter what. I mean, you know, the solar system will blow up in 6 billion years or something.
Mm-hmm.
It's like everything has a life cycle, even our whole world.
Yeah.
And it doesn't make it less beautiful because it's not eternal.
Yeah, no, that's very true. And I think that's why I come back to the idea of happiness, you know, and I, you know, in all honesty, in terms of my last book, the title came from the publisher. It was their suggestion, and we were kind of down to the wire. And so I just acquiesced, and I knew there was going to be trouble right away. You know, I thought, oh, you know, the word happiness can seem so superficial and shallow and sentimental and weird. And sure enough, the very first interview I did for the book, the first question was something like, are you trying to imply that the kind of happiness I feel when I have a really nice dinner with my wife isn't real? And I said, no, I of course do think it's real, and I think if anything we should try to appreciate it more and be more present and be more grateful, but we all know that it's changing and it's impermanent, and we need something that we can turn toward even when things are rough, even when we don't get what we want, even when we don't like our dinner, even when we don't like our wife, you know, even when we face, you know, some very debilitating circumstances. And so I tried to define happiness as something much deeper than just satisfaction and enjoyment. And we do need that. You know, we face change constantly, our own vulnerability, frustration, not getting what we want, and we face our own impatience all of the time and a need to not be disheartened and not be discouraged. And so happiness in that sense is really that which helps us keep going, and it's extraordinarily affirming and important.
Yeah, and yet there is that paradoxical transition, you know, when the heart is crushed and when the feeling is
mm-hmm.
that of isolation and despair,
mm-hmm.
it's kind of like that old story of the guy asking for directions to London and the farmer saying, you can't get there from here.
Mm-hmm.
It's as if you're in a world that excludes happiness in those moments. And what the practices are that enable us to rediscover the bridge
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
beyond that closure again and again.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's a lot of what you teach.
You know, because despair, I think, is the real sundering of connection. And that's, you know, that's what's so ultimately debilitating. And so even in completely honoring and facing and feeling the suffering we may have encountered through, you know, personal circumstance or the world situation, we can reweave a sense of connection to something bigger, whether it's one another or a bigger picture of life or even sometimes I think just to kind of a mystery, a sense of mystery or the unknown. I know we so commonly and conventionally say that we're afraid of the unknown, and that, of course, is true. But when I've looked at my own fear, one of the things I've seen is that I actually am not so commonly afraid. I'm not never, but I'm not so commonly afraid of the unknown. I'm more afraid when I think I do know and it's going to be really bad. And when I, you know, I just kind of build this world of like this terrible thing and that terrible thing is never going to change. And it's just like, and then when I come to a place of reminding myself, actually, I don't know, then it's like there's space and something opens up. And I think, yeah, right, I don't know. And so I think those things really need to be looked at, that we can, even connecting to a sense of the unknown can be a relief. And it's also true. You know, it's not like trying to comfort ourselves by telling ourselves nice things that are very untrue. All of this is based on seeing things more realistically, more truthfully, and that's why they're powerful.
Yes. That is really the question I need to ask myself in the deepest, most challenging moments, whether they're positive or negative, is what is real here? What is true?
Mm-hmm.
And there's this, I think at the core of that is often the paradox that in some way I am this mortal body mind with ultimately, you know, old age, suffering, and death before me.
Mm-hmm.
And I am also consciousness itself and wonder itself and being itself and joy itself. And, you know, I can arrive at either of those as if they're the irreducible, unavoidable bottom line. And I think the heart sometimes arrives at that feeling of being crushed and eliminated and rediscovering something transparent. To me, the not knowing opens me up to the luminous or the transcendent or the joyful.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And you teach meditation in terms of sitting meditation practice, but
mm-hmm.
you also teach a lot about how we bring some of that same awareness into everyday life.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd like to invite you to just expand on how these issues that all of us are holding. It's a little bit like whitewater rafting, isn't it? You know, life coming at us sometimes so surprisingly and from directions
mm-hmm,
we can't
mm-hmm.
expect, needing instant responses.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's true. And I think, well, really, in the end, I don't think people practice meditation to become a great meditator. It's like, I mean, really, ultimately, who cares? But, you know, we practice meditation to bring some of those skills into life itself. We practice meditation to have a better life. And so I do often describe meditation practice as a kind of skills training, you know, first of all, in concentration, so that we're not so distracted and we're not so... actually, the life experience of it, of that kind of scatteredness or distractedness, is often a sense of fragmentation, so that we feel very compartmentalized, we don't feel integrated, we don't feel whole, and just by taking our normally scattered, distracted energy and attention and bringing it more together around some object of concentration, we do experience a much greater integration of our being. And so it's a skills training in concentration, it's a skills training in mindfulness and being much more aware and in touch and with everything, the whole range of our experience, internal and external, emotions, sensations, images, sounds, conversations, whatever might be going on. We can be much more aware of just what we're feeling, what's happening in the moment, and have much more not only honesty but clarity to really understand deeply the changing nature of everything, for example, and the pain of holding on, of trying to be in control of what we can't control, and so on. And I actually think of meditation as a skills training in loving kindness or compassion as well, that those things aren't necessarily viewed, and certainly in Eastern thought, they're not viewed as gifts that some people have and other people don't. And if you don't have, say, a great deal of compassion, you're out of luck, you know, because it's not something that can be trained. It's seen very differently than that, where these are like skills that it's not like you force yourself to feel something you don't feel. It's not that kind of training, but it's an understanding that qualities like love and compassion also are very much based on attention, that if we look right through someone and we don't pay attention to them, they're like an object to us more than a person, then naturally we won't feel, you know, much empathy or compassion for them. Whereas if we really look and include them rather than exclude them, from our consciousness, we will care about them in a very different way, even if we don't know anything about them. In kind of personal story way, we'll just feel that kind of link or connection because we're actually looking at them rather than looking through them. And you know, so there are ways in which we train our attention to open and to refine and to really include that deeply affect the qualities of loving kindness and compassion that we can manifest in our lives. And so all three of those things, concentration and mindfulness and compassion, even though we might sort of practice them or train in them when we're sitting on a cushion or in a chair, they really, the whole point of doing that kind of training is because they affect how we are during the day, you know, how we are with others, how we are with ourselves.
Mm-hmm. And it might be helpful to try to maybe give some examples, practical examples of how that capacity for concentration might
mm-hmm.
create different options in a given moment, or
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
or that that mindfulness
mm-hmm.
muscle might transform the way we might dance with a particular challenge.
Mm-hmm.
If you have some stories like that, I think
mm-hmm.
that would be,
sure.
you know, likely to really be of service.
Uh-huh. Well, in terms of concentration, when I talk about scatteredness or distraction, I'm clearly, we know that so commonly, even if we don't meditate, if we just sit down to think something through or try to work through a dilemma or get to the bottom of something, we usually don't have a very steady or steadfast attention. Our minds jump to the past and we go over and over and over some situation where often, strangely, one where we're now filled with some regret, but we don't think about it in a way to think, oh, how might I make amends? You know, it's more just going over it and over it and over it, or our minds jump to the future. We create a scenario that has not happened and might never happen, and we're filled with anxiety about that. And so the example I often use in terms of the latter is, actually I was teaching with a friend, Bob Thurman, who's a professor of Buddhist studies at Columbia, and we were teaching together maybe like a year and a half ago, and I was talking about this, so I used this example. I said, it's like you're sitting on an airplane in New York, and you realize that your plane is going to leave late, and then you just start that arc of anxiety, like, oh, no, you know, what's this going to mean? Like, my plane's going to be so late. I wonder if I'm going to miss my connecting flight. Oh, no, I bet I will miss my connecting flight. And oh, no, what's that going to mean? It means, like, I'm going to land at Portland, Oregon, and it's going to be after midnight. Like, oh, no, you know, it's not New York. What if there are no cabs? What's going to happen to me? And, you know, it's going to be so dire. It's going to be so terrible. And I said, you know, as though Portland was famous for people, like, vanishing after midnight if they landed there. And so I said, when I see in my own mind, if I'm starting to go into that arc, I say to myself, well, something will happen, right? I mean, something will happen. There'll be a bus, or I'll spend the night in the airport, or something will happen. I can't figure it out right now. And so I just use that example. And the reason I said I was teaching with Bob when I did it was because maybe 6 weeks later, I got an email from him that said, just landed in Portland, lots of cabs. You know, and I thought, there you go, you know. But our minds just create this world, and then we feel imprisoned inside that world that we have manufactured. You know, very few options. What's going to happen? It's not going to work. Something dire. You know, and so that's just one example of how that fabrication really holds us back and has us feel so stuck. And just yesterday, as a matter of fact, I have a friend who's written a book called Ethical Wisdom, which is coming out any day, I think. Mark Matusik is his name, and I was reading an advanced copy of his book, and he was talking about, I live in Massachusetts, of course, but I have this little sublet apartment in New York where I spend some time, like right now. And Mark used to have an apartment in this neighborhood, and he wrote about going into this corner convenience store in his book, and he said that there was a woman who worked there who he found kind of grumpy. He just thought, oh, she seems to be in a bad mood so much of the time. And then he realized that from his part, in terms of the quality of his attention toward her, that he really had objectified her in some way, and he was regarding her, as he put it, as like being a cash register with arms. And so he went in there one day with a determination to actually pay attention to her and not just dismiss her as kind of the other. And so he did that, and he said he noticed, he wrote this in the book, he said he noticed that she was humming along with these things that were playing on the radio, and that she had a very, very beautiful voice. And so he said to her, you have a very beautiful voice. And she just like lit up, and she just beamed at him. And so that changed their whole relationship and his sense of connection. So I'd read that in the book, and I knew just who he was talking about. So some time ago, maybe a month ago, I went into the very same store, determined to say to her, I heard you have, or I heard you have a very beautiful voice, or whatever. But I walked in, and she was beaming anyway. She beamed right at me. So I thought, oh, look at that. You know, I had just assumed she was a certain way based on a little slice of acquaintance that I had with her, instead of really realizing this is like a bigger person. You know, she has more facets. She's more intricate, as is all of life. And so I went in there yesterday, and she happened to be humming. So I said, oh, you have a really beautiful voice. She really beamed at me, and although she had on other occasions as well. And I thought, you know, just look at that. Isn't it interesting that we can categorize somebody, we can dismiss them, we can create the other, we can rigidify the other, and that what we really need to do is have a kind of flexibility of attention, and that's something we trained. To remind ourselves, I'm holding on to a category, or I'm not really paying attention, or I'm looking at this person as though they were an object, as though they were a cash register with arms, instead of really opening to the more to the fullness of who they are.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And in that training, we build a capacity, but then the fullest expression almost seems like it appears in certain moments like a grace. I mean, it reminds me that in addition to the gradual school of regular practice, there is the sudden school of the happy accident of the opening of heart and mind and spirit. Apparently for no reason given by grace, but we get luckier if we practice.
We do get luckier if we practice.
Well, thank you so much, Sharon. It's been really a delight for me to dialogue with you this past hour. It's getting to be time for our Q&A, so I'd like to give others a chance to ask questions. A number of people have written in some really interesting questions in the instant teleseminar window. If you have a question for Sharon and you've called in by phone, please press *2 on your keypad to raise your hand, and I'll try to call on you. And if you have a question you haven't asked, please go ahead and type that in that window in the instant teleseminar page on your web browser. I'd like to make sure that you know how to find out more about Sharon's work. You can go to SharonSalzman.com, and there are a lot of really rich resources there. You can find out about all her books and tapes and many upcoming events, and there's even some rich Dharma resources right there, also her teachers and influences. Are there any things in particular you'd like to make sure people are aware of, Sharon?
Actually, it's SharonSalzberg.com, and When the book Real Happiness first came out, we did, because it's Real Happiness, The Power of Meditation, a 28-day program. And for the month of February, we did a 28-day challenge where many people were blogging about their experience. And I just found it fantastic, those blogs. And that's still up on the website somewhere. And you know, because we really tried to have a wide range of people. We had two firefighters and some police officers and a hedge fund guy and, you know, the range of people who were involved was just staggering to me. And I found, and we asked people to be really honest about their meditation experience and not just to say nice things, you know, to really talk about what their experience was like. And I just think it's an extraordinary document, that series of blogs.
Terrific. So that's SharonSalzberg.com.
Mm-hmm.
I also want to let folks know about my online course, Integral Spiritual Practice. I'm really happy about what has emerged from the creative process of creating this 8-week course in establishing a regular daily integral spiritual practice that engages body, mind, spirit, shadow, relationships, the whole of life. I've been really engaged with that for 37 years now, and I'm teaching it for the last 7. And what's obvious to me is how essential a rich and authentic daily practice is to happiness, transformation, and contribution, and how hard it can be to find your way into a truly transformative practice. It often seems like people have to choose between joining cults or hanging out in a kind of alone, in adrift in the kind of profane dynamics of popular culture where the sacred doesn't really get enough traction or build up enough tapas to help us really break through. So I feel really gratified that this course can take people in 8 weeks through a step-by-step process that takes you from really being a seeker to being a real practitioner in a way that's uncommon, because it's grounded in the most radical and the most embodied wisdom of the most highly awakened spiritual realizations and traditions. But it's also not a hyper-masculine path of just seeking and pushing. It's deeply heart-centered and self-compassionate and humane, and still generates the fire necessary for transformation. And it's in a doable way that's not too time-commanding. The first cohort of folks is just beginning to finish the course right now, and some of the folks are reporting that this program has really, for the first time in their lives, enabled them to really find themselves as a practitioner in a whole different way and opened a whole new set of vistas. So it's a dispensed learning course with audio and video and written materials and just wonderful, spiritually potent music. And you can download the course materials and proceed through it at your own pace. But you also can join a community of active practitioners who are engaging online and get guidance from me. So if you're interested to find out more about that or consider taking it, please go to your web browser and type in the URL, VISP Community. That's like Integral Spiritual Practice, theispcommunity.com. Also, please stay on the line. At the end of the call, I'll tell you a little more about what's going to be coming up with our guests. Barbara Marks Hubbard will be with me in 2 weeks on June 5th, and then just 1 week later, Byron Katie will be with me on June 12th. And then there's more coming, so, including A.H. Almas of the Diamond School. And then we'll open up our line so we can hear at least some of each other's voices as we say goodbye. Okay. Let's see what we have. Well, here's a poignant question from Jeffrey in Burlington, Vermont. He writes, "Despair is the sundering of connection. When I'm in my crushed mode, too stubborn to give up and too depleted to go on, I withdraw my energy from my friends and want to find solace in getting high, having sex, racing the engines in some way, anyway, an artificial way. Can you speak about ways to hold connection when I most need it, when I have the least, ostensibly, to give?
Mm-hmm. I don't know that, in truth, it's going to be a question of holding connection. I think that we all go through these terrible times where this sense of connection is just severed. It's more having the really bone-deep knowledge and confidence that you can renew it, you can reweave it, and that not all choices are going to be that healthy. And so even to find one way that is healthier, whether it's through nature, whether it's with an animal, whether it's taking care of somebody or helping out somebody who's, you know, that's the thing we think we have the least energy for when we're feeling so wrecked ourselves. But just being able to ease someone's burden a little bit in some personal and direct way. I have a friend who, after a long psychiatric hospitalization and lots of very devastating kinds of treatments, you know, found a quality of joy in making sandwiches for homebound AIDS patients and, you know, just something along those lines that can just bring forth a healthier sense of connection and understand, too, that all things pass and that devastation, while it seems like it's going to be there forever, and in fact isn't, and that there's the part of our minds that can look at it and know that's what we're experiencing and be kind to ourselves is the part of the mind that will actually endure.
Mm. Beautiful. Thank you, Sharon. We have a live caller from Westchester, New York. I don't have your name, 914 area code. You're live. Please let us introduce yourself and ask your question.
God. Thank you, God. Thank you, God. My, can you hear me?
Yes, we hear you. What's your name?
My name is Sydney.
Hi, Sydney.
Thank you so much. I was sitting here and starting, I was saying to myself, I know they're not going to pick me. Sharon, you have blessed me today. I am so grateful that I had the opportunity to be on this call. You spoke of recognizing people and talking with people. And the other day I went into a store here in White Plains, and one of the managers, I was talking with them, and she had on this different outfit, and her neck was showing. And I just said, from my loving, I said, oh, you have a very nice neck.
Mm-hmm.
This lady, she got beet red and started crying.
Mm-hmm.
And said out loud, she said, no one has ever told me that.
Mm-hmm.
And I realized then in that moment, what was given to her, and I was humbled. And also talking about being in the one that we all are one. Today I had to spend the day in because, a friend of mine said to me one day, said, Sydney, how can you walk around with your heart so completely open and your spirit so wide, isn't it dangerous? And when I heard her say that, I was like, well, I don't think about that.
Mm-hmm.
A few months ago, I was diagnosed.
Sydney, do you have a question for Sharon?
Yes. My entire muscular body is attacking itself.
Mm-hmm.
Even the tissues that hold the muscles to my bones. So talking about, my meditation has changed. How can The pain is unreal.
Mm-hmm.
How can I find peace there? You know, I had to stop my healing work and everything, and how can I, because I have to go on.
Yeah.
I wanted to give up. I wanted to, you know, take me away, but I have to go on. I want to be a part. I am a part of that change you're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
In this condition, unable to even do the little thing, how can I don't know if that's a question, but
mm-hmm.
I
well, and I think you already, you know, I love the story that you told about complimenting that woman, because even in the, you know, state of like really intense physical pain that you're in, and you were able to reach out to somebody and bring her some joy, which is really pretty fantastic. And so then the question, of course, becomes doing it for ourselves and,
yeah.
You know, and having, you know, it's our tendency, you know, we would say in Buddhist teaching is to have something really difficult and painful happen and then to add on top of it, you know, either future projection, like what's it going to feel like next week? It's going to be even worse
right.
next week, or add a lot of self-judgment on it, or humiliation, as though
right.
we should have been able to stop it. And so the first thing we really try to do is relinquish some of those add-ons, as we call them, and almost like bathe yourself in kindness. And it doesn't make all the pain disappear. I think that would be, you know, kind of a foolish
right.
aspiration. It's not going to work that way. But it changes the experience dramatically, because actually when we look at the quality of our suffering, we see so much of it comes from those add-ons. In fact,
yes.
even more so than the original suffering, which can be bad enough. And so I think there's definitely a path that you can follow that would make a difference.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you so much, Sydney. We have quite a few people have asked some really interesting questions here on the Instant Teleseminar window. Here's one from Raleigh, North Carolina. Steve asked, earlier in the conversation you mentioned thinking of people who encouraged you to take transformative risks. Could you comment maybe on one or two of those specific people and experiences from your life?
Well, I've had, you know, quite a range of teachers. I mean, sometimes one of my most profound teachers was a woman. Her name was, or nickname was Deepa Ma, or Deepa's mother. In fact, there's a book out about her now, Deepa Ma, who is an extraordinary person who was, she was probably my greatest role model, because I'd had such a kind of difficult and painful childhood, and I had the legacy of all that loss. And she was a woman who'd gone through enormous suffering in her life, and with the loss of two of her children, her husband, whom she loved very much, like a very sudden death. And so she got into meditation practice when she... they were living in Burma when he died, because he'd been in the civil service. And so when he died, she had one child left, Deepa, and she was so devastated by grief that she actually went to bed. She couldn't get out of bed. And it being Burma, the doctor came and said, "You're actually going to die of a broken heart unless you do something about your mind." He said, "You should learn how to meditate." And so she did. And they say that when she went off to the meditation center, she was so weak that she actually had to crawl up the temple stairs in order to get into the meditation room. And yet she practiced, and in part, of course, because she had a surviving child that she needed to take care of and she needed to recover. And she just emerged as the most kind of awesomely loving and compassionate sort of person, because It's like she knew, you know, no matter what your situation is, it can change really radically, and no one is immune, and we have to take care of one another. And she had this extraordinary kind of generosity and love and compassion, and she was really an enormous influence on me.
Mm. And just by the depth of her presence, kind of came out of that story.
Yeah, and I think the way she would, you know, like, she was very nurturing, you know, toward everybody. Like, can I get you some tea? Can I give you something? You know, what would you like? Even though she was, like, a very kind of accomplished and highly realized meditator, there was no kind of formality. There was no distance. And she was just incredibly kind and encouraging toward everyone. So she's an example of, I mean, not only have I gone through this sort of challenge with the word happiness, but my first book was Loving Kindness, and that, of course, is a big part of my life's work, is that particular approach. And, you know, that idea of kindness or love or compassion is also often considered kind of weak and like a secondary virtue. You know, if you can't be strong and you can't be brilliant, like, okay, be kind, you know, it's a little something. And you know, so I spent quite a number of years almost in defense of that concept and saying, you know, love is a strength, it's not a weakness when understood properly. And she was an enormous example of that, you know, of how I mean, just the sheer power of that force of love and kindness was really special.
Mm. Beautiful. Thanks so much, Sharon. Rene Potique from Fresno writes, I struggle with no self.
Mm-hmm.
I experience sadness and hopelessness. My tummy aches when I see homeless people,
mm-hmm,
and killing and torture. What would be an appropriate meditation activity for the meditation group I lead? Thank you very much. You usually hit the button for many of us, Gesso and Shalom.
Thank you. Well, I think there's something about loving kindness practice that is, it helps us understand, if you, you know, by no self you mean the kind of Buddhist teaching about emptiness, in a different way, so that this idea of no self isn't like wiping out a self, and it's not that everything kind of disappears. It's not really nihilistic. It's more in the sense that I was talking about the string bean before. A very common example would be to look at a tree and realize that on one level we can see the tree as though it was just a singular entity standing there, but there's another way of looking at the tree and sensing the soil, which is nourishing it, and everything that affects the quality of that soil, like the rainfall, and then everything that affects the quality of the rainfall, which we know now is so vast and so many different things. And so we can look at the tree and sense this network of relationships and connections and influences, all kinds of things. And that's the way we can look at everything. We can look at ourselves, we can look at others, we could look at everything in life. And that kind of perspective has us understand that nothing stands alone. That's really what we mean by no self, that there's nothing independent and cut off ultimately. Everything is born out of causes and conditions. And I think both because it's true, it's important, and also because it revolutionizes the way we relate to ourselves and to others. It's also important. And so that's the kind of reflection or meditation I think is very useful to do.
Mm. Thank you. From Toronto, Charles writes, Hi, Sharon. I have always been sort of tightrope walking on how to balance the personal wisdom happiness quest with throwing myself out there in full holy activism that seems to pulse with such an urgency today. How could I possibly be sensitized differently, somehow non-dualistically, in all its practical glory? I think so that he could not oscillate, be doing both at once somehow, be alive in them as a singleness. I think that's what he means. Any suggestions? I'll read it again, make sure I'm not interpreting it away. Balancing the personal wisdom quest with full holy activism that pulses with such urgency. How could I be sensitized differently, non-dualistically, in all its practical glory? Any suggestions?
Well, I think sometimes also from within the context of the Buddhist teaching, we can look at action, anything that we do or anything that we say, as having three components, and I think they all figure into your question. The first component, which is considered of critical importance, is the intention or the motivation. What's motivating us to do something, to expend our energy, to show up somewhere, to make an effort in some direction? Like, what's the real motivation? And only we can know. And it's interesting because, you know, you can watch somebody hand somebody something and it looks like an act of such sheer generosity, but we don't really know what's motivating it. But the person themselves, you know, they might be giving that object because they like the person, or they might see that that other person has something they really want, and they might think, hey, I'll give you this and you'll give me that, or a thousand other things. And so from the Eastern point of view, certainly from the Buddhist point of view, the motivation is a very critical component of the action. And so that's something we look at through mindfulness and awareness is, you know, where are we really coming from? Or another way of saying it is, what do we really want? And that's going to make a big difference, having that kind of knowledge. And the second aspect of an action after motivation is, you could call it the skillfulness or the skillfulness of execution of the action, you know. So we learn certain skills. We learn skills of communication, and we learn from mistakes. We learn from feedback. We really pay attention to a context. You know, what we decide to do, do we give this person money, do we not give them money, do we put our energy here, do we put it there, is going to be very contextualized mindfulness. Like, where are we? What's going on? What's our best guess about the most appropriate thing to do in this particular context? And the third aspect of an action is the immediate result. And that's where one of the places where your inner work, one's inner work, has a very direct bearing, because we need to let go of all those expectations and that sense of, you know, it's got to work by tomorrow, or I've got to be the one to fix it, or whatever it might be. There needs to be a real equanimity and an ability to let things take their time, which doesn't mean we don't act fully and passionately and with great intensity. It just means we act with fewer expectations and demands and less impatience. And so really one's practice, one's inner work, has an effect on all three of those areas.
Beautiful. Thank you. You know, looking at the Instant Teleseminar window, I see three or four questions that are, well, there's kind of, they're asking two sides of some extreme kind of situations. One of them is, Marianne from Portland, Oregon asked.
Hey, lots of cabs.
Well, this is Oregon, not, it Oregon you were meaning?
I
was imagining Maine. Okay.
Yeah.
How or why can one be happy when a beloved one of 30 years is suffering greatly physically, mentally, emotionally from a terminal illness?
Mm-hmm.
And then from Boston, Marianne, sort of on the other side of this, more personal, how would you apply your teachings to someone who's been disabled by illness for many years and lives alone, feeling isolated because of that? Feelings of connection arise at times, but much of the time the aloneness and isolation is the predominating sense. The illness is one that keeps me homebound much of the time.
Mm-hmm.
And there were some other questions that are pretty similar.
Mm-hmm.
You know, really, in a way, Sydney, who we heard from by voice,
mm-hmm.
was asking about, you know, in a different way, about some mm-hmm. of those same challenges.
Mm-hmm. I think in terms of, first, you know, I think we need to really read define the word happiness. I mean, if it means feeling good about or satisfied or feeling pleasure, then I don't think there's a way in the world you're going to, you know, feel that as someone you're close to is facing death, and nor should we want to, you know. But I think there is a kind of peace that is based on wisdom that not only helps us, but helps us help the other person. When our own distress is the most predominant force because we feel betrayed by life, that this is unnatural, this shouldn't happen, you know, then clearly we're out of step with reality. And part of that's the burden of our cultural conditioning around control, around permanence, around, you know, the ways we're taught to seek these totems against change and as though they would protect us from death. And so here, too, I mean, there's a question of timing, you know, because I wouldn't expect the kind of wisdom or perspective, you know, in the face of, like, immediate trauma to be the most predominant thing. But overall, I think there is a kind of peace we come to because we realize this is in the nature of things. And that's what helps us help others, both the beloved person who's, you know, who's facing the illness right now, and also others, because it takes a lot to almost defy the cultural norm, which has us feel so isolated, like it's our fault this has happened, that this shouldn't have happened, that this is a personal humiliation, that we've grown older, that we're sick, that we're dying. But we can find that, and when we find it for ourselves, then we can really help others in the face of that. And then in terms of the person who's seeking connection, I mean, of course it's very difficult. And again, I think we have the huge burden of a tremendous amount of cultural conditioning that has us isolate ourselves, has us foster isolation when people are different in some way or struggling in some way. But both within one's own heart, I think, I know for sure one can feel the fullness of connection to all of life, and that is really, that conviction is coming from my own meditation practice. And also there are just ways of reaching out to others that are, you know, that don't demand physical presence, that don't demand travel. You know, there's an online world as an example. I don't mean to trivialize that, but I mean, even just listening to you describe your seminar, I thought, how fantastic is that? You know, that's really great. There are lots of ways that we can really move outside of that sense of isolation.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Thanks so much, Sharon. We're just about out of time, I think. So Before I tell you all what's coming up and before we open up the lines to say goodbye, a few reminders. If you value what you're receiving here, please support our work by letting others know about it. They can register for this series for free at beyondawakeningseries.com. Please also consider supporting my work and enriching your life by taking my course, which I described earlier, Integral Spiritual Practice. And you can find that at the ISP community, theisp community.com. And to learn more about my other work and see videos or audios of my other writings, visit integralspiritualpractice.com. And again, those of you who want to see the journals of those who spent February engaging the 28-day program that Sharon teaches in her new book, Real Happiness, or just want to familiarize yourself with her work in any other way, go to SharonSalzberg.com. I also want to tell you about the Integral Incubator. If you're inspired by an idea, a project, or a personal calling, you can bring it to a 5-day seminar at Boulder Integral that's designed to usher you into your next stage of effectiveness. Using your own work and your intentions and aspirations as your object of practice, It's led by my dear friend, Jeff Salzman, and includes a visit to integral philosopher Ken Wilber. It's a unique way to workshop your idea into being. The next one starts June 27th, and there will be one other in 2011 in October. And you can find out more at integralincubator.com. Now, what's coming up on Beyond Awakening? On June 5th, I'll be talking with Barbara Marks Hubbard about what she calls suprasex, which is really a higher form of mimetic rather than genetic cross-pollination and co-creativity and ecstatic enjoyment that's necessary at this time to our further evolution. And I'm very excited to be engaging that with Barbara, who's a dear friend. On June 12th, just 1 week later, I'll be in dialogue with Byron Katie, the originator of the work and one of the most disarming, lively, irreverent, fresh, very clear spiritual teachers of our time. And we're just nailing down the dates. I'll be talking soon with A.H. Almas, also known as Hamid Ali, the founder of the Diamond Heart School. And stay tuned. There are many other remarkable conversations that we'll be having in time ahead, including one a repeat conversation that I'll be having with Andrew Harvey soon. We had a very lively dialogue, and there were some incompletes there that we're going to rejoin and engage. So thanks so much for joining Sharon and me today. Let's open up our phone lines now so that we can hear each other's voices and say goodbye. Goodbye, everybody.
Bye.
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 Thank you.
Bye. Thank you.
Thank you for joining us.